Last week, the U.S. Department of Justice announced that it would temporarily suspend support for a legal advice program for detained immigrants, as well as a telephone helpline. It's not the only legal barrier facing those in detention. A new lawsuit claims that federal immigration officials make it difficult for detainees to communicate with their attorneys. The lawsuit filed by the Southern Poverty Law Center names two Georgia detention centers. Lisa Grable is the Southern Poverty Law Center's legal director, and she joins me now from San Antonio. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning.
And with us on the studio in Atlanta is Atlanta-based immigration attorney Hiba Gallab. She works with detainees in this state. And Hiba, let me start with you. Just before we get into the specifics of this lawsuit, what's the background here? Everybody who's watched television knows that in the normal course of the criminal justice system, someone who's under arrest or in detention, they have a right to an attorney. I get arrested. The cops have to let me call my lawyer. And if I don't have one, they have to provide one for me at no cost. What are the rights of people who are being detained on immigration offenses or alleged immigration offenses? What are their rights to an attorney?
Yes, thank you for having me, Adam. This is actually the core of the issue. The U.S. Supreme Court has held for decades now that immigration proceedings are civil and not criminal. So there is no constitutional right to appointed counsel. And a detainee or an immigrant in removal proceedings, they're supposedly there to determine eligibility to remain in this country. It's not a punishment for unlawful entry. It's ironic. It's unfortunate, though, because oftentimes what happens is that the same person might be who may be detained and facing, you know, a night in jail for a minor misdemeanor, but because it's a criminal charge, they're entitled to legal assistance. But if they're facing, immigration violation, consequences are lifetime exile. We're talking about a lot of times we're dealing with clients that are facing very treacherous situations back where they could be deported. And so this is the reality of the situation. They're not, they don't have a right to appointed counsel. They do have a right to representation, but that's on their own expense, of course.
So practically speaking, though, aside from what the Supreme Court says, but practically speaking, what ends up usually happening? Do people who are being detained for immigration offenses end up getting a lawyer most of the time?
Most immigration detainees are not able to, mainly because of the financial burden it would bear on them, because these are very complex cases. It's very oftentimes just challenging. These are a lot of respondents already have, many of them a financial, constraint anyway. They have lack financial resources to hire private counsel, even if they can financially afford it. Sometimes if they're detained, it's just simply logistically difficult. If they don't have contacts on the outside, then how are they supposed to do the research that it would take to find a credible, competent immigration attorney to represent you if you're detained?
Now, let me turn to Lisa Grable with the Southern Poverty Law Center. You are suing federal immigration officials and naming two Georgia detention centers, immigration detention centers in particular, in that lawsuit. What are you alleging?
Well, the problems that Hiba described are exactly why the Southern Poverty Law Center started the Southeast Immigrant Freedom Project about a year ago in April of 2017. This is because the representation rate at some of the detention centers in the Southeast, including the two detention centers we've named in Georgia, are even lower than average around the country. Only 6%, for example, of the immigrant detainees at the Stewart Detention Center in Lumpkin, Georgia, were represented by counsel before SPLC opened this direct representation project. And what we did was bring lawyers and open offices in the towns where these small towns where these detention centers are located. But what we found, even when we brought volunteer attorneys from all over the country who were willing to come give of their time to increase the representation rate in these southern detention facilities, was that they cannot get access to their clients. For example, the Stewart Detention Center, the one in Lumpkin, has a capacity of 1,900 detainees, but only 3 attorney visitation rooms. In contrast, the nearest county jail has about 19 visitation rooms for a population of up to 1,000 detainees. So it's very difficult for attorneys attorneys to access their clients. They have to wait hours on end to get into the attorney visitation rooms. And then even once they get inside, the rooms are divided by heavy plexiglass, and the attorneys have to speak to their clients through a closed-circuit telephone, which becomes functionally impossible once you add an interpreter because many detainees are not fluent in English. We've asked to be allowed to bring in telephones, offered to have ICE examine the telephones to ensure the numbers are limited to interpretation services, but that hasn't been permitted. So we brought suit, alleging a violation both of our right, SPLC's right, to fulfill its mission by representing these detainees and of the detainees' right to access counsel and the courts.
We contacted the federal agencies named in the suit. They've said, not surprisingly, that as a matter of policy, they don't comment on pending litigation. ICE, however, did put a little addendum onto their rejection to our request for comment, where they said, in general, ICE's highly trained law enforcement professionals adhere to the Department of Homeland Security's mission to carry out their duties in accordance with federal law and agency policy. ICE respects the rights of all aliens, their term, not mine. ICE respects the rights of all aliens in removal proceedings to hire and or consult with a lawyer of their choice and has policies in place to ensure that aliens may do so to the extent required by federal law. Hiba Gallup, in your experience as an immigration attorney here in Georgia, how does that square with what you see day to day?
Yes, actually, I wanted to express my appreciation for the organizations, nonprofit organizations that are actually able to represent on a low bono or pro bono scale. And we're very grateful also for this lawsuit, because not only is it important, but it also draws attention to this issue. Representing detainees, on one hand, transactional immigration matters are, challenging and complex, but for an immigration attorney to not only take on deportation defense, but also detain deportation offense, and especially if it's like 2.5-3 hours away from where most practitioners reside, this is very, very time consuming. It's labor intensive. It's unpredictable. For me to represent a detainee, for example, in Stewart, which I have many times, I have to take off a day of work, block off an entire day just to have a 10-minute in-person conversation that I have to actually plan ahead in a fast-paced removal proceedings. And it's fast-paced because they're detained. This is very, very impractical for most private practitioners, but even for these nonprofit organizations that are really sacrificing a lot just to make themselves available. And even on top of that, to add insult to injury, they don't have the access that they should have. I mean, we have to jump through hurdles just to be able to get in the building. Honestly, it's ridiculous. If people realized how hard it is just to get inside and to talk to our clients, I don't even understand how we can call that actual representation.
One other thing that we know about from the normal course of the justice system in the United States is that there's this thing called habeas corpus, right? Like, we have a right to a speedy trial, or if we're detained by the justice system, we have to be brought before a judge very quickly in order to figure out what's going on. What's the case in the immigration system, though? Do people who are detained on alleged immigration violations at centers like these, do they have a right to have proceedings go quickly for them, or can they just sit there for a long time, Lisa?
Well, the Sixth Amendment, which guarantees the rights that you're talking about, isn't actually the constitutional amendment that's applicable here. What we're talking about here is the Fifth Amendment, because, again, immigrants who are in the country without permission are not accused of committing any crime. What they are standing accused of is only a civil violation, which is one of the arguments we make in this lawsuit, that there's no reason for the level of security protection, because the people that we're trying to meet with are literally accused only of a civil crime of breaking the civil law of the country, not a criminal violation. So ICE does try to expedite proceedings for people who are in detention, which just makes the need for representation that much more critical. When you think about the reasons that immigrants may be seeking to stay in the United States, for example, a fear of persecution in their home country, what they need to be able to present their asylum claim is information about country conditions, incredibly complex. In fact, the Supreme Court has recognized immigration law to be as complex as the tax code, really difficult. And yet, without representation, detainees are required to navigate this thicket on their own. And you can see why the success rate of immigrants who are detained is 10.5 times less likely to succeed in their petitions to stay in the United States if they have to continue with their case while they're detained. That's why bonding them out and getting them out of detention is such a critical piece of what SPLC is trying to do with our Southeast Immigrant Freedom Initiative.
Okay. So, HIBA, in the last minute that we have here, pending the Southern Poverty Law Center's lawsuit in this particular case, people who are affected by this issue, people who may be held on immigration offenses, or people whose family members may be held on alleged immigration offenses, what's the best advice that you can give them to make sure that they have adequate legal representation? What can they do to protect themselves?
I mean, this actually impacts all of us. We have detained people that are detained a lot of times indefinitely, it feels at least, because the judges struggle. Sometimes they have to remain impartial, and if they're not represented, they need to be able to represent in a way the respondents, because they aren't represented. And so we actually just all of us need to be aware that we are amount of time and resources it takes to resolve these cases for unrepresented individuals, it would be drastically reduced. We could save countless tax dollars just to be able to move these cases forward. And actually, if we can help make sure that people that don't have representation, don't have access to representation, enable them to achieve that, if there is a way for awareness to help in that regard, that would be great. Obviously, retain counsel. Don't underestimate that these are complex areas of law. And so make sure that you have representation if you're detained. But even if you're not an immigrant, just understand that this is actually something that could be of help, not just to the immigrant community, but also to us as taxpayers, because it can move cases along and definitely aids in expeditiously, hopefully also, in making sure that everybody's constitutional rights aren't violated.
That's Hiba Gallup, an Atlanta-based immigration attorney. We were also joined by Lisa Grable from the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is suing U.S. immigration authorities over, among other things, practices at two Georgia immigration detention centers. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Last month, students from all over the country hit the streets to demand stronger gun control laws. In the wake of that March for Our Lives, many local governments have proposed tougher restrictions on guns. One place with a decidedly different approach is Kennesaw, Georgia. In 1982, Kennesaw City Council passed an ordinance requiring heads of households to maintain working firearms and ammunition. That's right. If you live in Kennesaw and you don't have a gun, you may be breaking the law. In a moment, we'll learn more about the difference the law has made in the community. But first, let's look at how mandatory gun laws fit into the gun control debate. Lois Beckett covers guns and gun violence for the British newspaper The Guardian. She's reported on mandatory gun laws and spoke with my colleague Leah Fleming.
Lois, last year you wrote about a place called Nucla, Colorado. It's a small town where, like in Kennesaw, residents are required to own guns. We're going to talk about Kennesaw in just a few minutes, but first let's talk about Nucla. In 2013, it passed this home protection ordinance. What does it say, and what inspired the legislation?
In late 2012, there was a mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, and a lot of states pursued stricter gun control laws, including Colorado. So Colorado passed a law requiring background checks on every gun sale, even private sales between private citizens, and limited magazine capacity to 15 rounds or less. And Nucla is a town in very rural Colorado. It's a long drive to the nearest town that's big enough to have a Walmart. And they were pretty frustrated with, once again, what they felt were symbolic gun control laws infringing on the rights of gun owners without any safety benefit. And so one member of the town council looked to Kennesaw, Georgia, and their gun ordinance, and proposed in a meeting, why don't we do that here? Why don't we require every household to own a gun? And this was Richard Craig, a former board member. And he said, he had kind of been joking about it, but everybody loved the idea, and they voted on it, and it passed.
So is it something that they actually enforce?
These laws are more or less unenforceable. In Nucla, there are exemptions for households who can't own a firearm because they can't afford one, or if they're conscientious objectors. So no, this is not something that is really being actively enforced, and it isn't particularly meant to be. The thing about Nucla is that everybody had guns already. This wasn't about pressuring people to do something that was different from what they already had done. It was about making a statement about values and making a statement about the kinds of laws that were being passed in Denver by urban people who didn't necessarily understand what gun culture meant to the people of Nuclea, and were making lots of political decisions that weren't really taking every voter into account.
So was it controversial when Nuclea passes in places around Colorado and in some of the major cities?
It's really important to understand that this law in Nuclea is kind of an inside joke that the town played on the rest of Colorado and on the rest of the country. It got huge amounts of attention from the press, a lot of attention from gun rights advocates. They were praised, and you know, reporters from all over went and keep coming to the town. I was one of those national reporters that descended on the town. And you know, at the end of the day, like, this was a symbolic thing. You know, the Brady Center to prevent gun violence was upset about it, wanted to fight back legally against this. There was, you know, lots of outrage. But this is a town that's had its jokes and has stoked outrage before nationally. They previously got in trouble for hosting a prairie dog shoot that attracted a lot of environmentalists to protest hunters shooting prairie dogs. And so the town pretty much took it in stride. They were proud of it. There was some controversy in town over it being like a little bit too much of a joke. But at the end of the day, people supported it in town. And, you know, those outside town were sort of fighting against more an idea of what they thought the ordinance meant or what they thought gun culture meant in Nuclea, which was very different from the reality of what the role guns play in the town.
So since this mass shooting at a high school in Parkland, Florida, several Florida cities have sued over a state law there that actually prohibits local municipalities from enacting their own gun control measures. Where do municipalities like Nuclea and Kennesaw, where do they fit into the debate over gun control?
What's so interesting about local control over gun regulation is that it is something that the NRA and gun rights advocates have been fighting against for decades. In the early 1980s, Morton Grove in Illinois banned handguns, and this was seen as a very dangerous sign of what could be a local grassroots movement spreading against gun rights all over the country. And the way that gun rights advocates responded to this and it was tremendously effective, was by passing preemption laws that said that gun regulations could only be passed at the state level. And state legislatures, because of the way districts are drawn, tend to skew more conservative. So one of the sort of underappreciated victories and centers of power for the National Rifle Association is the fact that they cut off local advocacy for gun control laws at the root, starting in the 1980s, with preemption laws that are now in place in most states across the country. And if you can't fight at your local level to pass local gun control laws, and if at the state level it's very hard because states sort of tend to skew conservative, then you're sort of left to push for gun control laws at the federal level. And that has been a tremendous barrier for gun control activism, because it's really hard to build a movement when the small victories that you might practice and build for are blocked, where you can't even fight that fight. And so for Florida cities to contest that isn't just contesting their right to pass gun control laws. It's about changing a balance of power and giving and potentially giving back power to local communities to start the gun control push at the local level.
Mm-hmm. According to the FBI Uniform Crime Report, Kennesaw had only one murder in the last 6 years. And I'm wondering, does that mean that perhaps more guns mean more safety, or is Kennesaw just simply an outlier, do you think?
This is the most debated question about guns in America. Do more guns make us more safe or less safe? And mm-hmm. I think the answer is that it's more complicated than either side really wants to acknowledge. Some places like Kennesaw or Nuclea, these were not places that had a lot of gun violence even before the gun ordinance. When I went there, I talked to the local EMT in Nuclea, and he said there had been one shooting. Some guy had shot at a police officer the year before. And before that, the last shooting he could remember was in 1986, that sometimes people got drunk and there were accidental shootings. This happens, but it wasn't a place with a lot of violence. And it's also true, and gun rights advocates will remind you, that since the early 1990s, the number of total guns in America has gone up by an estimated 70 million. So 70 million more guns. And meanwhile, the gun homicide rate has dropped by about 50%. So there's not a simple correlation that, you know, more guns equals more safety or more guns equals less safety. If you look at the actual national and even local trends for homicide, you'll see the pattern is a lot more complicated. And there's huge debate and conflicting studies over, you know, whether, for instance, encouraging more people to carry concealed weapons in public tends to increase violence or decrease violence. So I think it's just a little messier than anyone wants to acknowledge.
So why pass laws like this?
I think one of the fundamental factors behind this kind of political move is that gun owners are really frustrated by the way that America's gun debate is carried out, and the fact that it is always, it always happens in the aftermath of a particularly heinous act of violence. If you talk to NRA members about what they think about the debate, they'll always say the media only focuses on the bad side of owning guns, only on, you know, the horrific accidents or murders or mass shootings, and they don't acknowledge the times where guns are used in self-defense. In the NRA's magazine or in gun rights, advocates have long sort of produced lists and examples of when gun owners use guns in self-defense. But the bigger picture to either of these sides to say are guns more often used in self-defense or are they used in a suicide or an act of domestic violence or a murder is that there are 300 million, 400 million privately owned guns in America, and most of them aren't being used in a helpful or a harmful way. Most of those guns are just sitting in someone's gun safe or in a, you know, in someone's bedside drawer, and they're not actually causing any harm. And I think it's really hard in this debate to really capture that, that there is definitely harm caused by guns in America. There are people who feel that the guns are very helpful and that there are times that made them safer, but there are so many Americans who know that their guns aren't being misused every year. They feel like the debate misses that, that doesn't capture that guns aren't always misused, that a lot of people use them quite safely, that gun owners don't need a lot of extra safety training, that it's not accidents that are really driving America's gun injury and gun death crisis. It's acts of violence by people who are doing them purposefully. It's gun suicide. And so, you know, the idea that people who don't own guns are saying, well, why isn't there more gun training or asking for more requirements when gun owners know that most of them aren't misusing their guns, I think that's a real source of frustration.
Do you think we're going to see more places like NUCLA and Kennesaw start to introduce these types of gun ownership laws? Could something like this even work nationwide?
I certainly haven't heard of anything happening at the national level, and I haven't heard yet of any cities who are doing this at the local level. But I imagine that somewhere out there, someone's looking at Kennesaw, someone's looking at NUCLA, someone's looking at the reaction to all the students marching in, across the country. And again, thinking, you know, it might be time for us to make a statement. And this is a statement that we can make. It might not have much of an impact, but it will express our values and it will show what our town believes in, no matter what people in the state capitol might think, no matter what's happening in Washington.
That was Lois Beckett. She covers guns and gun violence for The Guardian. She spoke with my colleague, Leah Fleming. Now to Kennesaw to learn more about its ordinance requiring heads of households to have a gun. Joining us on the line is Kennesaw Police Lieutenant Craig Graydon. He's the commander of the Criminal Investigations Division with the Kennesaw Police. Good morning, Lieutenant.
Good morning.
So this ordinance passed the Kennesaw City Council in 1982. You've been around for a really, really long time. You've seen it its entire history. I was born in 1982. So put me back in the cultural context of that year. What was going on? What was the Kennesaw City Council trying to say by passing an ordinance like this? Were they making a joke like that town in Colorado?
I don't think it was really meant to be a joke as much as around the early 80s, there were a couple things going on. The metro Atlanta area had really started to see a dramatic increase in population, and there was some concern with the increase in population that would lead to increased crime. So one of the reasons the ordinance was passed was hopefully to make it a deterrent to criminal behavior. That way people would think twice about breaking into a home in Kennesaw if they thought every homeowner owned a gun. But also around that same time, the city of Morton Grove, Illinois, had passed a city ordinance basically banning handguns from the city limits. So the city council and the mayor at that time thought it would be a good way to show support for our citizens' Second Amendment rights to pass this ordinance as well.
There are exceptions to the requirement, however. What are they?
Oh, yeah. If you have any kind of physical mental disability, you cannot afford a firearm, or you're just conscientiously opposed to owning a firearm, or if there's other legal restriction, i.e. convicted felon or something like that, you would not have to.
Are you aware of any instance in which authorities such as yourself in Kennesaw have done anything to enforce this ordinance?
No. It was pretty much a symbolic gesture. It was never meant to be an ordinance that was enforced, and there's never been an incident that I'm aware of where the ordinance was ever even attempted to be enforced.
Okay. So went up to Kennesaw and talked to some folks about this. Let's listen to their voices. We talked to Kennesaw resident Susie Morrell. She told our producer, Leighton Rowell, that she has mixed emotions about this ordinance.
I'm not for guns. I don't want guns in my house. To me, it's dangerous.
How do you think the law here in Kennesaw is working out? Do you think it's a good thing?
Probably that's a good thing. That's why probably Kennesaw is safe. People don't know if you have a gun or not, so they're not going to take a chance to come to your house. Probably it's a plus there. But still.
And that's where she trailed off. But let's go over to another longtime Kennesaw resident. This is Wayne Odom. He is planning to get a gun, and he says that he believes Kennesaw is safer because of this ordinance requiring heads of households to have guns.
In my contemplation, if I was going to choose to rob a house, and if I knew that one town had an ordinance that you must own a gun and the other didn't, I think I would just do the odds.
So Lieutenant Craig Graydon with the Kennesaw Police Department, as we heard earlier, the research on what an ordinance like this would do to gun violence is limited and contradictory, and partially just because there's so little experience with it. But based on your lived experience of having been a law enforcement officer in that community for many, many, many years, do you think having this ordinance on the books has made Kennesaw safer?
I think it's definitely contributed to a safer community. It's hard to say, just like the studies kind of, you can see studies that point both ways as far as increased gun ownership and its effect on crime. I think there was some positive benefit from the deterrent factor, but the main thing from the police department perspective that we've kind of enjoyed from the ordinance being passed is that it kind of keeps the conversation about violence and crime prevention on people's minds, and it kind of helps us a little bit reach out and to the community more often to have those discussions about how can we prevent crime, how can we prevent acts of violence.
What about suicide? Lots of research indicating very, very strong correlation between rates of gun ownership and suicide. Is that something that affects you in Kennesaw?
No, we've not ever seen a significant number of suicides above what would be expected from this size community.
So what do you think other communities could learn from your example?
Well, what we try to strongly encourage, and I think the thing that we're most proud of from the police department, is that that this is just a single element of an overall crime prevention program that, you know, that we stress working with the community, working, you know, that we work very closely with schools, youth groups, faith groups, et cetera, to reach out there and try to target the cause of violence, not necessarily the instrument that's used in violence. And I think it's something that each community needs to look at to see if an ordinance like this would be appropriate for them or not.
How do you feel about it being Kennesaw's claim to fame on the national, international level? I would venture to say it's the thing Kennesaw is most known for.
I pretty much agree that it's probably the especially outside the metro Atlanta area, it's probably what Kennesaw is most known for. And it's kind of one of the ironic things that probably the majority of the inquiries we get about our ordinance come from out of state or even out of the country. So we get quite a bit of interest into how it's worked for us and exactly what it is.
How do you feel about that?
Like I said, it helps. I think it helps generate some conversation about not necessarily just gun ownership, but violence in general, which, you know, I think that's a conversation that really needs to be held on a national level, is what causes the violence, not so much what's the instrument of violence. Like, you can look at London's experienced a huge surge in homicides that are knife related. So those are things that I think that, you know, everybody needs to look at. What's the root causes of the violence, not so much the instrumentality of the violence.
That's Lieutenant Craig Graydon. He's a lieutenant with the Kennesaw Police Department. He's in charge of criminal investigations there, talking about Kennesaw's ordinance requiring heads of households to have firearms. Thank you, Lieutenant.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, we want to hear from you on this one for sure. What do you make of this debate? Do you think that your community would be safer if more people had guns? It might be counterintuitive for some folks. What do you think about when you look at the example of Kennesaw? Let us know at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to our Facebook page. The South has a lot of nicknames: Dixie, the Bible Belt, and also the Stroke Belt. Studies say that stroke risk in this 11-state region that includes Georgia is 34% higher for the general population than it is in the rest of the country. A new initiative is trying to change that. With me to talk about what the Marcus Stroke Network is doing is James Lugtu. He's the National Clinic Program Manager for the American Heart Association and American Stroke Association. Good morning, James.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, quickly remind us, what's a stroke?
A stroke is basically two mechanisms. One is either a clot in the brain or actual active bleeding in one of the vessels in the brain, causing a disruption of flow. And then seeing some disruption in physical signs, weakness on one side or the other, facial weakness, arm weakness, and slurring of speech is some of the major signs of a stroke. It's basically just a disruption of flow to the brain.
Okay. Often deadly, or when it's not deadly, debilitating, right?
Absolutely.
All right. What's going on in the Southeast? Why would rates of stroke be so much higher in the Southeast than in the country at large?
You know, there's many studies out there looking at why there's such a high prevalence of stroke in our area. And there's really a lot of hypotheses of why this is the reason. Some believe it's because the high rate of high blood pressure, diabetes, and other comorbidities in the South that increases a person's risk of having a stroke. Others feel that it could also be the diet and inactivity that's common in the South. You know, we have a very slower pace of living, which is great for stress, but also could cause a higher risk of having a stroke because of being sedentary and inactive. And the great food that we all enjoy, it could also have a factor in raising our increase of having a stroke.
All right, what they call lifestyle factors, the South's lifestyle factors, causing us to be more susceptible to stroke. We talked to Dr. Michael Frankel last week. He's the director of this new Marcus Stroke Network that's trying to address stroke prevalence in what they call the stroke belt, this 11-state area of the Southeast that includes Georgia. Frankel is also chief of neurology and director of the Stroke and Neuroscience Center at Grady Hospital, Atlanta. He says the faster that you can get to and help stroke patients, the better.
The earlier we can recognize stroke symptoms, the earlier we provide treatment, the less damage there is to the brain, the better people will do. So we want people to survive and thrive, come back to their lives in the community, and that's the goal.
So, James, I imagine that's a big part of what this new initiative is about. How do you get to stroke victims faster? How could that be achieved?
One of the big things is actually having these individuals calling 911 and really initiating our system of care early into the process. That would require education of our public to recognize a stroke. American Heart Association, American Stroke Association has done a wonderful job in really pushing the FAST education, recognizing a stroke, looking at FAST, which is face, arm, speech, and then the importance of time of calling 911. And the Marcus Stroke Network is really working closely with two of our large comprehensive stroke centers in Georgia, the Grady Memorial Hospital and Emory University, in collaboration with the American Stroke Association and American Heart Association's quality-based systems of care expertise to form the Marcus Stroke Network.
Okay, so let's actually unpack a little bit of those warning signs in greater detail for the audience. You mentioned face, arms. What would someone actually see on a person who seemed to be experiencing a stroke?
Just as we mentioned there at FAST, the face you would see what's called asymmetry, or one side may be drooping other than the other side. And a quick way to really recognize if someone's having a stroke, if you suspect that, is to ask them to smile and to see if one side goes up and the other is either flat or it seems to droop. The other large sign of a stroke is an arm, or an A of FAST. And this is where there's weakness on one side or the other. You would, in this case, you would actually ask the person to raise their arm and notice if there's a drift. There's one side weaker than the other. And then speech. Ask them to repeat a simple sentence, just like you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And see if their speech is clear, is it garbled, or sometimes they may actually replace some words with other words. And those are some of the more common signs of a stroke.
Let's go back again to Dr. Michael Frankel, who's director of your new Marcus Stroke Network. He's at Grady. And he says that age plays a big factor in stroke as well. Let's listen.
Particularly with an aging community, a lot more baby boomers entering the stroke-prone years, we have to be better prepared. We're very well prepared for trauma. We need to be prepared for stroke. This is a method to help us become better prepared for what to do when a stroke strikes.
So, James, it's logical for us to think that that stroke would be something that would disproportionately affect older people. That makes a lot of sense. But what about younger people? Do young people have strokes?
Absolutely. Actually, you can have a stroke at any age. In fact, in the last few years, we've seen an increase of individuals under the age of 65 having a stroke. So
really
anyone can have those risk factors, and if they're not controlled, run the risk of having a stroke.
An increase among young and middle-aged people having a stroke. Is there any thought as to what might to what that might be attributable? Is it just the lifestyle factors you were mentioning before, poor diet, lack of exercise?
It could be. Those are really some huge factors that some of it is genetics. We have a population of individuals. African-Americans have a higher risk of having a stroke. Recently, in the last few years, we've seen a huge increase of Hispanic individuals also increasing the risk of having a stroke. So those are some of the things that could be contributing towards the young age. Another thing, too, is the increase in cigarette use, especially with e-cigarettes. This is really we've seen an uptick of individuals, even younger and younger, utilizing that, thinking that's much safer than a regular cigarette.
So even an e-cigarette, something that doesn't involve combustion, that can impact health in such a way as to exacerbate risk of stroke?
Correct. There's not an absolute study yet that ties the two together, but we've seen a correlation of the increase of smoking and also increased risk of stroke.
Oh, fascinating. All right. So what's happening with this collaborative regional approach? You've got lots of players at the table to work on this problem of elevated risk of stroke in the Southeast.
Absolutely. We're glad to, the American Heart Association, American Stroke Association, is really honored to work closely with the Marcus Foundation, the Grady Memorial Hospital, and Emory University Hospital to form the Marcus Stroke Network. And really, one of the big goals of the Marcus Stroke Network is to utilize the strength of those two facilities, the expertise of the Marcus Stroke Network physicians, and extend that to the rural areas of Georgia through the use of telemedicine. It literally is bringing those doctors right into those smaller hospitals or even into the mobile stroke unit, which is an ambulance that has a CT scanner inside of it. They'll be roaming around Atlanta. So that's really an opportunity to bring those expertise of those physicians into those smaller hospitals, smaller rural areas, and also that mobile stroke unit.
That's James Lugtu with the American Heart Association and American Stroke Association. Thank you and good luck with this effort.
Thank you.
Listeners, we want to hear from you. Have you experienced stroke? Anyone in your family experienced stroke? What do you wish you had known then that you know now? Share your knowledge with everybody else. 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk or on Facebook. You can search for our show page. It's called On Second Thought. And another question for you listeners. If our traditional and beloved diet here in the South is killing us, what should we do about that? 404-500-9457. Let's hear from you. Now let's add two more songs to our Georgia playlist. For this, we asked people to pick the best songs from and about Georgia. The rules are simple. All tunes must be written or performed by a Georgian, and artists cannot pick one of their own songs. We talked with Marcus Free of the Atlanta-based R&B group Hamilton Park. Here are his picks for our Essential Georgia playlist.
How you doing? My name is Marcus Free of Hamilton Park. We are a local group here in Atlanta, Georgia. We've been together for about 8-plus years now, and we sing R&B. The first song I want to talk about for the Georgia playlist is Elevators by Outkast.
One for the money, yes sir, two for the show. A couple of years ago, on Headland and the Low. What's the starter? Something good. With me and drove the martyr through the hood. Just trying to find.
Numb lyrics stick out simply because a lot of our beginnings started on public transportation on MARTA, where we would travel on MARTA and we would hand out CDs out, and we would just start singing to random people on MARTA. So that song, like, every time I hear it, it just takes me back to those beginning, those humbling moments of Hamilton Park first beginning.
This shit must stop, like freeze. We making the crowd move, but we not making no cheese, and that's a 1-2.
Dope, in the Cadillac, they call us. Went from Plagueis Ball to Ball, putting the South up on the map. It's like Little Rock to banging, say mother that plaguing.
So the first time I actually heard the song Elevators by Outkast was by one of my older siblings. They had been playing it throughout the house. And the reason it stuck out because we grew up in a Christian household, so you couldn't play hip-hop. So when he played it, I took heed to it because that was the only hip-hop I was able to get.
Got stopped at the mall the other day. Heard a call from the other way that I just came from. Some was saying something.
talking about, hey, smoke something.
Your man make from school?
No, not really, but it kept smiling like a clown, facial expression looking silly, and it kept asking me.
I started listening to it, and then I began later down the line traveling with my brothers as far as throughout the south side of Atlanta, you know, Helen and DeLo. And I was like, man, this feels just like what Outkast was singing about. This feels just like what Andre 3000 was talking about. Like, I connect to this song just like how I'm living what he's saying as we got on Martyr, as we were, you know, riding up and down those same streets.
Rolling down the strip on bowls, coming up, slamming Cadillac doors. Me and you, your mama and your cousin too. Rolling down the strip on bowls, coming up, slamming.
The second song I want to talk about for the Georgia playlist is Gotta Be by Jagged Edge.
Don't want to make a scene. I really don't care if people stare at us. Sometimes I think I'm dreaming.
That song, it just takes me back to when we, before our first deal with Atlantic, and we all learned Jagged Edge. Now, if you're a connoisseur of music, you understand if you're going to sing a Jagged Edge song, you cannot mess it up. So we began to dissect it and learn who would do what, and we actually built our blend off of the foundation. They said that's their blend.
It's your love. You know I got to be. Oh, baby, I gotta be.
Gotta Be, it's the common song. I gotta be the one you love, baby. I gotta be the one you touch. And it's pretty much just talking about how a guy, I have to be everything. I can't just be one thing to you. I want to be everything, what you love, what you need, what you feel. And in essence, it's a love song. The first time I heard Jagged Edge Gotta Be was probably when I was trying to flirt with this girl on the school bus. And if you know me in the group, I'm a little extra. So I've always been extra. And they would separate the girls on the right side and the boys on the left side. And so what I would do is when the bus driver started driving, I would sneak over to the girl's side and I would start singing Jagged Edge to her.
I just gotta be.
And the bus driver, of course, pulled the bus over and escort me to the side. I got rolled up a couple times off of Jagged Edge Gotta Be. We was at a party in 2010, 2011, and we were hosting it. And Jagged Edge so happened to have a booth in the same club we were in. And they had heard about us, and we had, like, quickly ran across them. But that night just confirmed how much they were behind us. To have people you study, people you've learned their techniques to become great like they have, and to come up to you and say, guys, I see y'all working. I'm proud of you. Keep it going. It felt like the torch was being handed off to us.
That's Marcus Free of the Atlanta-based R&B group Hamilton Park. He shared his picks for our Georgia playlist, and that was produced by On Second Thought intern Emmanuel Johnson. You can find the entire series along with all of the great music segments that we've done at gpbnews.org.